Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, and this...
Good morning.
...is a voice called Perfect Paul. Perfect Paul sounds a lot like cosmologist Stephen Hawking, doesn't he?
I have been very lucky that my disability has not been a serious handicap.
Hawking, who lost the ability to speak due to complications of ALS, is the most famous person to use this artificial voice to express himself. But lots of other people have had to sound exactly like Hawking, because for a long time there just weren't many options for turning text into spoken speech. Rupal Patel believes there should be, including voices matched to users' age, sex, and personality, so that a young person might sound more like this.
I like things that a lot of girls like sleepovers, chocolate, and chilling with my besties.
Rupal Patel is director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University. We learned about her work from an article by Bradford Pearson in the current issue of Southwest the magazine. You can find more at her company's website, vocalid.co. Rupal, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be here.
I don't know that people necessarily give much thought to the extent to which our voice is part of our identity, but a voice is as unique to each individual as a face or a fingerprint.
Absolutely. I think that we don't think about it or we take it for granted what our voice means until we can't use it or until we miss a voice that we can no longer hear again. So I think we do know how important it is, but every day we don't think about the value of saving it or thinking about what would happen if you lost it because it's just such an integral part of who we are.
And our voices also allow us to recognize one another when we can't see one another and to know something about somebody we might only talk to on the phone. So in other words, I'm hearing your voice and I can guess a lot about you. I can guess approximately how old you are. And of course, I know your gender. But this is the kind of thing that voices also do for us.
That's right. And sometimes, you know, when we hear somebody who doesn't quite sound their age or doesn't seem like what we picture them to sound like, it's quite an about face, right? You kind of have to turn around and say, oh, is that the voice that I had connected to this person? We also actually have a lot of cultural biases about what we expect people's voices to sound like if they were educated, if they, depending on their sexuality, depending on, you know, their education level, depending on whether they, what kinds of hobbies they have. Like, you hear someone with a raspy voice and you make assumptions about the way they use their voice. It's fascinating how much voice is tied to our beliefs about people and who they are.
How common is it for people to need an assistant voice at some point in their lives?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more common because nowadays I think the seamlessness between how we use technology when we can't use our voice, you know, even people who don't have impairments necessarily sometimes are using devices that talk. You see people who are blind who need to have a screen reader read out loud or visually impaired read out loud information. So there's many times where we do use digital voices. And then on top of that, there are these millions of people, about 2.5 million in the U.S., who are living with voicelessness due to conditions like cerebral palsy, autism, ALS, stroke, head and neck cancer, a variety of different reasons that leave you voiceless or at least having a very difficult time using your natural voice.
And these are people, I mean, without a voice, we really are cut off from a lot of normal social interactions, even if our brains are working well otherwise.
That's right. You know, and sometimes when I use that statistic, people say, really? There's that many people? I've never seen them. And I think a lot of that is because when you can't speak and when you have that much of an impairment that you need a device to talk, it's extremely isolating. Sometimes people who've had stroke, for example, are unable to speak and their worlds become completely collapsed and they don't end up meeting and going out and actually using a device to communicate because they end up communicating only with the few people that they know and who can understand what their needs are. So I think what happens with communication impairments is they're very, very invisible and it isolates further the individuals who are afflicted by them.
Rupal, what kinds of interfaces are available right now for people who require the help of a digital voice or an assistant voice?
There's a full range of devices depending on the individual's communication abilities as well as their cognitive abilities and their stage in life. So some people are voiceless because of a birth, something that happened during birth, such as cerebral palsy. So young kids who have cerebral palsy may use a device that has pictures on it because they haven't learned how to read and write yet. As they become older, they may use more conventional devices, like even just keyboards where they can type in and that'll turn into a voice. Someone with ALS may start off with a keyboard, for example, or an on-screen keyboard that then gets converted into speech. But as their disease progresses, they may need to use a system that has an eye tracker on it because they don't have function of their hand anymore to be able to select the items on their screen. So there's a variety of different kinds of input methods, as well as the way that the devices look will be different depending on someone's cognitive ability or physical ability as well.
And on the horizon is something that would allow someone who maybe formerly could speak that can't vocalize anymore, they could move their mouths and have an artificial voice work for them?
Yeah, I think you're talking about some of the work that I've been doing with some of my colleagues on silent speech recognition, where if you put some electrodes on someone's face and head and neck area, you can capture the tiny movements that are responsible for speech production. And combined along with a number of other features, you can start to predict which words they're saying just from their mouthing of the words. That attached to then one of our voices allows a person to potentially speak as themselves, but without having an actual acoustic voice that they've produced.
How were the first artificial voices developed and how were they tested for, the ability to be understood?
Well, there's a long history of creating digital voices. You know, it dates, actually, there's an exhibit in one of the museums in Washington, Smithsonian's in Washington, talking about the whole history of how computerized voices came to be. And initially, they were very large apparatuses to try to replicate speech. And so it was a model of speech production. You try to create how speech is produced using bellows and chambers and tubes. And that's what we call sort of model-based speech synthesis. The earliest voices of these sounded like speech, but they were still not very clear and also not very convincing in terms of, nobody would think that that is an actual person speaking. But it is producing sound that we understand to be speech, right? Over the last 2 to 3 decades or so, there's been more advances in something we call concatenative synthesis. As computation becomes cheaper, we can record a lot of speech and then cut it up into little bits of speech that can be recreated or recombined to say words and phrases we didn't say before. And now, in the last 10 years, there's even more advances that show that we can actually learn computationally what speech is like from a bunch of recorded speech. So you record speech, you build a computational model of that speech, and then you can now again get it to say things that weren't said. But it's created from human speech, but it's not taking little bits of it and gluing it back together. It's actually creating a computational model. So there's a huge evolution of this research over time.
What made Perfect Paul the gold standard for so long?
Yeah, Perfect Paul, there's a lot of investment in speech synthesis research for a while because we're fascinated. I mean, for scientists and technologists have been fascinated with understanding speech and as well as producing speech. So Perfect Paul became the standard because it was understandable to a considerable degree. And it also was the first time we were starting to sort of interact with our machines, our computers. And so it became the gold standard for a long time. Because that was one of the options. You know, interestingly, there wasn't a female voice for a long time. In fact, speech scientists didn't study female voices or children's voices until probably like 50, 60 years ago. It's pretty remarkable how recent it is. Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible because you think about, it is strange to think about giving, Perfect Paul maybe sounds like if you put a 42-year-old white guy into a computer, this is what he would sound like. And much of America, much of the world doesn't sound that way.
Yeah, but I think until even more recently, if you think about your GPS voices, right, they're very, very... prototypical, stereotypical voices of what you expect someone to sound like, American man, you know, American female, Australian male, Australian female, and so on. And so I think this thought about that technology should have a better relationship with the people using it is really a new conversation that we're having today, because technology is finally getting to a point where we can make this happen.
So what you're looking to do is to take bits and pieces of donor voices and sometimes pieces, recordings of the voice of someone who previously was able to speak, and combining them. I mean, as a concept, it sounds relatively simple. The execution, I know, has been much, much more difficult. What's the breakthrough in what you're doing?
Yeah, well, the breakthrough is the identification that someone who cannot speak still has the ability to produce sound, and that sound has enough of their, quote, vocal DNA, right, that we can extract that from them and then use just that little bit of information, about 2 seconds to 3 seconds long of their sustained sound, to then color the recordings that are created by somebody who's matched to them in age and size and demographics and so on. And then the way that we blend that tiny voice sample with the hours of recording from that matched donor, that's the breakthrough, is making it sound like the person who we wanted the voice to be for, right? Hmm. Yet has the clarity of the person who was their surrogate speaker. What you are describing, the bits and pieces, we're not quite doing bits and pieces like I was talking about in the TED Talk that I gave a couple of years ago. Now we're actually mixing the voices and then building the computational model of their voice, which actually gives us a lot more control over the ability to make that voice more expressive as well.
What's happening with a voice like Siri that many people are familiar with? There are some words and phrases that she says that sound a little more naturalistic than when she's just telling you to turn left or turn right if you are driving somewhere. How much of that is recorded from a human, and how much is created with those kinds of algorithms and computations that you're talking about?
Well, all of the Siri's voice was created from a voice actor who recorded her voice for several weeks in a sound booth. And then those recordings were used to create the synthesized voice that we hear. There are some words and phrases that don't quite sound right, especially if those words are from another, if they're a foreign word, they're not an English word. So they don't follow what we call the phonotactic patterns, the frequency patterns of the language. And then other words and phrases that are more common and frequently said were maybe even said by her. Hmm. And so they're closer to the replication of just what she had said, right? So, and that technology that's being used in Siri is what I was describing earlier, the gluing together of the little bits of speech. And because Siri is such an expensive voice, it was such an expensive voice to build, there's a lot of smoothing of the voice that was created where you join the little bits together. And so sometimes you hear these sort of inconsistencies or glitches, and that's because not everything has been smoothed over, right? But, you know, Siri is on our extreme end of how good can it sound if you have, you know, unlimited budget and unlimited time to record these samples. It can sound pretty good. It still lacks a little bit of naturalness. And one of the things I'd say with Siri is, even though it's a good sounding voice, there's this uncanny valley about it in terms of, you know, it's not a human, because you and I, when we talk, we hesitate. There's other things about our voice that make us sound human.
Hmm. We're speaking this hour with Rupal Patel. She's director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University, and she's the founder of Vocal ID, a company looking to give voice to people who can't speak. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. By the way, if you follow the show on Twitter and you follow me at Chris Boyd Think, I would love for you also to follow at KERA Think. This is where we are going to be tweeting to you and accepting tweets for the show throughout the show. The thing is, I'm just not so good at tweeting back to you while I am on the air, so we decided to put together KERA Think at KERA Think on Twitter. That is managed by the staff here. I will still be tweeting at Chris Boyd Think, but this way you can send things directly to the show. My guest for the hour is Rupal Patel. She's director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University. She's the founder of Vocal ID, a company looking to give voice to people who can't speak. You can learn more at vocalid.co. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Rupal, in some settings, for example, special ed classrooms where more than one student uses a digital voice, everybody might sound the same, and this can be really confusing.
That's right. Yeah, it's not uncommon, you know, to find several kids in a classroom with kids with autism or cerebral palsy where they're using the exact same voice. And they may be of different ages. They may be from different cultural backgrounds. And the same voice is often used.
Tell us about Tess Gregoric.
Yes. So Tess is a young woman that I met, or her family, when the TED Talk first came out, they were the first family to email us and say that, you know, one of the first families to say that they were interested in the voices that we were building. And at that point, we were still in the laboratory and weren't really, it wasn't something that we were able to do at scale. And over time, they sort of followed us with what we were doing. And then last summer, Anne had reached out to me and said, when we were running this Indiegogo campaign, said that she really wanted a voice for Tess. She's a young woman who's spunky, has so much in terms of what she wants to say, and uses one of these generic sounding voices that's commonly used in by young women.
So she's never been able to speak, but she is mentally in terrific shape. She's been writing poetry and books since she was like in kindergarten or first grade. It makes perfect sense that she would want to express herself with sounds that feel like a young, vibrant girl.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the preconceived notion that people have of people with cerebral palsy or other, you know, communication disorders is that they can't think. In fact, many of these people are trapped in bodies that will not allow them to express themselves, but their brain is fully intact. There's a fantastic book written by a woman named Sharon Draper, who talks about the story of, you know, a young woman who has cerebral palsy, trapped inside this body that doesn't move, yet can see and observe the world around her, and wants to participate in that. And, you know, and Tess is very... Not only is she writing poetry, she does math better than most people, and she's brilliant. Brad actually had a chance to meet Tess and her family, and, you know, and she is definitely on an extreme, but there's so many others like Tess like that as well, who we sometimes think, well, if they can't speak, is there, you know, what else is there that they can't do? But, you know, many times the cognitive aspect is actually relatively preserved, or if not above what people would even give them a chance to think that they have.
How did this become your professional passion?
I've been working with people with cerebral palsy and people who can't speak for more than half my life now. I first learned about speech-language pathology back when I was in my undergraduate, and it really kind of was, I started working with people with head injury, so people who had traumatic brain injuries, and I was fascinated by how the brain sort of reconstructs itself and is able to reshape in the chance that you have some kind of an insult or traumatic insult like that. But it doesn't happen by itself. I mean, there is some spontaneous recovery, but therapy itself is actually important, and therapy at the right time is important. So that kind of got me into the field initially. In terms of the voice, though, it was when I was starting to work with children with cerebral palsy, and actually adults with cerebral palsy as well, right after becoming a speech-language pathologist in the Toronto area, I started seeing this this technology of artificial, or not artificial, but automatic speech recognition being used by people with spinal cord injury. And I thought, well, can't we use speech recognition with people who have speech disorders, just because they have consistent speech impairments? Can't we build a machine that could recognize their voice? That kind of got me in this path. And I quickly realized, though, that you can't just build a machine that can recognize disordered speech, because disordered speech isn't always consistently impaired in the same way. And the models that are used to build a speech recognition system are built on healthy speech. And so that kind of got me thinking, well, what is it that they're doing consistently, because their familiar communication partners are continuing to understand them? So it's kind of a long, circuitous path, but there was a number of things that happened in my career and lifetime as a clinician, and then later as a researcher, where I kept seeing that there were opportunities for technology to intervene and to harness what people who couldn't speak could still do with their voice. They can still make sound. Tess can still make sounds that her mother recognizes as hers and not of her other two sisters, right? And that is important to harness so that we can give everybody the ability to express themselves in all the different mediums that they can. So, it's probably far too long a journey to describe on radio, but there are multiple different things that happened throughout my lifetime or throughout my career that has made this a passion. And certainly seeing and working with people who have speech impairments and knowing that there's so much more there, I want them to have the full opportunities that technology can help us unlock.
What do you mean when you talk about donor voices, that people whose voices are fine, that want to assist with the development of this technology, can do?
Sure. A donor voice, so there's people all over the world right now who are contributing to our voice banking platform. And they can range in age from, six all the way up to 91 years old. We have about 12,000 people currently on the platform, but it's a pretty big ask. We have to have you read about 3,500 sentences for us to be able to create a digital representation of the voice. And we're always going to take the donor's voice samples and use it to blend with the sound sample that we get from the non-speaking person to create this unique vocal identity. And in some cases, though, some people are donating their voice or contributing their voice to the voice bank for themselves. Hmm. A gentleman the other day who called us after he'd read the story in Southwest Magazine told me that he was going to have a total laryngectomy. His entire voice box was going to be removed within 20 hours of the phone call that we had. And so what did he do in that last period of time is he began recording his speech and banking his speech for himself so that we can take those recordings and then recreate this voice that he had when he can no longer speak. And that will be something now he'd be able to type into an iPad or a computer, and then that would turn into the text would be turned into speech, but the speech would be not that perfect Paul voice or that, other generic voice, but it would be his voice. That's a really powerful thing.
It's incredibly poignant to think about that and think about it being important enough to somebody that, the last... some of the last words that they get to say are sort of prolonging their ability to sound like themselves.
That's right. It's your legacy.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the time we don't think about voice and capturing that voice. I mean, obviously we have recordings of ourselves, we have video, we have all sorts of other things. But in this method of banking your voice, we can actually recreate things that you may not have, had the fortune of thinking about saying. So people that you're going to meet that have different names, this person probably would never have recorded Rupal, right? and so now they can actually, say those words that weren't pre-recorded because of the digital representation that we are creating of their speech.
I'm curious about the 3,500 sentences. How were they developed? And, is it the oral equivalent of the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog?
Yeah. So the 3,500 sentences come from a variety of different context. So there's a bunch of sentences there that are commonly used sentences that we would want to say. So if the I love yous and how are you doing and so on. So common phrases. Then there are a few phrases and sentences that come from passages that that are phonetically balanced. So they have all the sounds and sound combinations. And then there's also a series of sentences that are from texts that are out of copyright. And they were compiled in that way so that we'd have a large enough database of speech from which to build a speech, a synthesized voice. We are working right now, actually, within Vocal ID on reducing that set of sentences. And what we're finding in our initial findings is that you can reduce the set of sentences, but the quality of the voice will deteriorate a little bit, as will the intonation. So the more speech you have, the more likely you can make it sound more natural and more the inflections of speech that we currently have. But if you don't record enough speech, then there isn't enough to learn how we vary our speech, in different contexts and also just to be more expressive.
Hmm. How much inflection can you put into a synthetic voice? For example, can you record the same word multiple times so that if, a sentence ends with a word that makes it a question, the intonation sounds different?
Yeah, so the basic intonation with punctuation is typically there. And if you type into Siri and you bold certain words, or if you put a question mark at the end, you will hear some of that intonation. But intonation is tricky. In fact, that's the primary part of my research is the same cues that are used to signal excitement or to signal that that's a linguistically stressed word, those cues overlap. And so there isn't a one-to-one relationship between only certain acoustic cues are always used to express a question. In fact, some questions have a higher, like a increasing pitch contour, and other questions have a falling pitch contour. So the context in which you use speech and the way you're being expressive can actually change a lot. So, you could be sarcastic with a variety of different ways. And different people actually have a different valence in terms of how expressive they are or less expressive they are, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a very tricky thing to try to endow emotion and intelligence and some a lot of the intonational aspects of naturalness of your voice into synthetic voices. But the newer synthetic technology that's being developed is trying to capture that. And some of the ways you can do that are by having people record in different kinds of moods, right? Mm. So if you have a more happy sounding speaker throughout the entire recording, you're going to be able to capture that. But, again, that's a pretty subjective, and there's a lot of variation. But not everyone who wants to be sounding happy is sounding like, they're really bouncy, and yeah. So there's a variety of different ways in which you can express yourself that isn't easy to capture with an algorithm.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because even a sentence as simple as "How are you?" You can say "How are you?" You can say "How are you?" And I wonder if there are plans to somehow allow the person who needs to use this voice to speak for them to add some things that don't exist in punctuation currently that would select from, different intonations.
Yes. So our laboratory at Northeastern University, the primary focus is in an aspect of speech called prosody. So prosody is the changes in pitch and loudness and duration. So, for example, if you said, how are you, right? So that increasing in intonation is a prosodic contour. What we're finding in people who have severe communication disabilities is that the prosody is relatively preserved. What's not preserved is the ability to make clear consonants and vowels. And so that's actually where this work on Vocal ID first began, is where we started finding that there were some parts of speech that they could still produce well. And so they not only can do that relatively well, it's not like it's perfect, but it's better than their ability to produce consonants and vowels. But they can also understand it. And so what we're doing is things like, once you make a sentence, are there ways for you to push that word up and down in a on a screen so that you can change the pitch of the voice by moving it upward to make it sound higher pitched and moving it lower to make it sound lower pitched and so on, by changing the duration of the voice, of the word, by stretching it on the screen. So we're working on different visual spatial interfaces that once a sentence is created, they can endow some of these prosodic variations to it on top of it to be more expressive. That's wow. One thing that we're doing. And then we're also thinking about ways in which we can put sensors on the person's face or neck to capture some of the tension and vocal fold differences that they can still control well, to think about ways in which we can augment their ability to speak clearly, as well as being expressive.
I have to imagine, Rupal, that speed is also a concern. You want to give people as much control ultimately as possible over the sounds that they are producing, the speech that they are using. On the other hand, there's already a bit of a delay because you have to have these inputs and you have to have processing time. So what are the trade-offs that you have to make with regard to how quickly sounds might be produced?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the biggest thing is how long it takes to create a sentence. If you can't speak, you have to, like, type it in. So there's this delay there. In terms of how quickly the speech can be generated, that's actually pretty pretty quick these days. I think the other thing, though, is you and I like probably voices that speak relatively quickly because that's sort of it's similar to the way we speak. But what we've noticed is that many people who are building the voices for who are non-speaking actually prefer their voices to be a little slower. And that's because some of them have auditory processing difficulties. And so they need to understand what their voice is saying out loud for them. And they tend to actually slow it down even more than what may feel natural to you and I. And that's interesting because that control is actually very important for them to have. But it may give the perception that they're, in fact, slower cognitively than they want to be. So there's this interesting tension or perhaps how do you match the technology for the user's needs but also for the perception of others around them. I feel like what we're creating with Vocal ID is this interface in between where it's not just for the voiceless person, but it's also for the people around them. And you've got to make sure that there's a compatibility or at least some kind of awareness that people understand why the voice is at what the speed it is at. And what does that mean? Who is it for?
Rupal Patel is my guest. She's director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University and founder of Vocal ID, looking to give voice to people who cannot speak. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can tweet us at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rupal Patel, director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University. We're talking about her company Vocal ID, looking to give voice to people who cannot speak. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERA Think. Rupal, we have a tweet here from Cordy, from Kevin, who says, what's the time frame when it might be possible to hear voices that are indistinguishable from real ones? Will we get voices like her and Ex Machina that sound just like humans?
You know what? It just depends on how much people are willing to invest in speech science. And I think for a long time, we were complacent with what technology could do. And so we're okay with the thing talking to us like Perfect Paul. And if we want that variety of voice, I think the more investment we put into speech synthesis and in speech science, we're going to get there. There's a lot being invested into recognizing speech, and now we're getting pretty good at that. So it's a matter of time and investment into if you want that to happen.
We haven't talked about regional dialects. Here in Texas, even people who don't have much of a drawl say things like umbrella and insurance. Is there yes. the capability to make somebody sound like where they're from?
Yes. And that's the whole point of the Human Voice Bank initiative. So the Human Voice Bank is really this distributed way to gather English speakers. Initially, we're starting off with English, to gather the voices of people from all over the world, of all ages and accents and voice types and cultural linguistic backgrounds. So whatever you record, like say there's a speech donor in Texas that's going to be recording those samples of speech. If you take that sample and you mix it with someone, you're going to hear the clarity that they have or the way they produce the sounds that will have more of a Texan accent as opposed to someone up here in Boston. In fact, you know, we've got one guy here in Boston who really, really wants a Boston accent as his accent when he speaks with his device. And we need more people who are actually going to complete, not just start the voice banking process, but actually complete the full set. Because if you don't complete the full set, it makes the voice not very clear and understandable, and that's obviously not what we're looking for. We want an authentic voice, but also one that's clear and understandable.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Phyllis on the line in Dallas. Hello, Phyllis.
Hi there.
Hi, go right
Thank
ahead,
you
please.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Well, the reason I was calling, you just answered part of my question. I am a 70-year-old woman, and I am from Texas. And I wanted to know if there were some way or how I would go about volunteering. I have done a lot of reading in schools for children, and I'd like to volunteer.
Sure. So thank you, Phyllis. You just go to our website. It's vocalid.co/voicebank, and you'll need a computer that's running Chrome, and you'll need a headset microphone. And there's actually some details on the website that will explain and walk you through the process. But it's very simple. We'd love to have your voice. You have a beautiful voice, and I'm sure there's other people that would love to be able to use a voice as clear and authentic as yours.
I was surprised to learn that you can use just sort of a regular computer, and those headset microphones are under $50. That's enough for you to extract the kinds of sound information that you need.
Yeah. I mean, technology's come so far, and that's why that makes this really possible. You do have to be in a quiet room, and so the better the quality of the recordings, the better the voices that we can build. We do put in a lot of checks and balances along the way. So if you're recording in a room that isn't quiet enough, the system will tell you that it's not quiet here. Please move to a quieter location and so on. We ask for the headset microphone because that means the distance between your mouth and the microphone is consistent. And so the recordings are of a consistent quality.
Stephen wants to know if there's a cost to donate one's voice.
There is no cost to donate one's voice.
You've done a lot of this research thanks to crowdfunding. Can you talk a little bit about why you went that direction and how well it's worked for you?
So we actually did a crowdfunding campaign last year to fund the creation of the first set of voices and also to see if there were enough people that wanted voices so that they would pre-order voices for this year. Starting something like this in this kind of a market, you need to validate that there is, in fact, people that are willing to and have the capacity to purchase this technology. And so that's where we started. I think it was a good way to see what the appetite was. It is still a market that there's a lot of education to do in terms of letting people know what this is, why the technology costs what it does. It's several orders of magnitude cheaper than anything that was available before, yet still it's a cost that is, $1,249 for us to build a voice for someone today. But it wasn't even possible until very recently for the common person to have a custom voice. So it's very cutting edge, and it's one of these things that you've got to get the word out in various ways. Crowdfunding is an easier way to do it when you're resource strapped in the initial parts of the startup.
We have an email here from Tom who says, I'm a voice donor and actively encourage friends to become one too. Do you have a goal for the number of donors you want or can handle?
That's a fantastic question, Tom. We have, right now, we need more people to complete their recordings. We've got about a 10% completion rate. And that means, and that's really, if you don't complete the full set of recordings, then we can't deploy that voice for someone who needs it. And it's not so much the number of voices that we need, but we need the breadth across ages and across regions and across accents and voice types. So it's great. We need the word out to get the word out to lots of different people. This summer, we are doing a summer ambassador program where our goal is to have 500 voice completions through the summer. And we've actually got 100 voice ambassadors who have signed up for this summer, 6-week summer program. If people are interested, they can tweet at us or email us at hello@vocalid.co.
Do you think in the future this technology could be employed by, well, first of all, let's talk about what is on the horizon. Maybe you send me an email and I want my computer to read it to me and it comes to me in your voice?
Sure. There's lots and lots of applications where our voices can be used. And really, what we want to be is the voice inside those applications. We're not going to be creating all those different kinds of applications. But yeah, you know, the voices that we build are pretty small in terms of the footprint that they take, around 50 to 70 megabytes. And so if you have an application that you want to turn that text into speech and you want that speech to sound like a particular person or even more, you know, a greater variety than what you have today, then a Vocal ID voice can be used in that application.
And it may be that people whose voices work just fine bank a voice, pay Vocal ID to have that voice customized so that they can use it on other applications. Is that correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So yesterday we were talking to an individual who is going to have actually part of his tongue removed from tongue cancer. And so, you know, he might want to bank his voice so that he can use it when he's no longer able to speak clearly himself. So he would be able to type into his phone or his iPad or some kind of a system, and then that text would be turned into speech so that he can communicate with everybody in his own voice.
Have you been surprised at how fast this is happening?
Maybe it feels slow to you.
I mean, it seems like you all have made so much progress.
We have made progress, but I mean, we've also been at it for, you know, the basic research we've been at for about 7 to 8 years now in terms of how do you actually extract the vocal identity from one person and then combine it. In the last 2 years, we've really started thinking about how do you do this at scale, mm-hmm. right? How do you get people from everywhere to contribute their voice? Because otherwise, this would be a much, much more expensive product. And you wouldn't even get the diversity of voice that we can get now with people of all ages, of all backgrounds recording their voice. You have a variety of voices that typically wasn't possible if you're just sort of auditioning for voice talent. So there's something really interesting about how today the interest that society has in doing things of, you know, social importance. So there's, you know, we've got teens on our platform, we've got adults, we've got seniors. You know, what's really exciting is that people are engaged and they can help make this happen for the person who can't speak, but also in the future of, do you want a device that can speak out loud that your emails, if you're driving and you want to hear a variety of, or the emails that are coming into your mailbox, but it's very hard to kind of audio index when it's the same Siri voice reading every single email. What if it could read it out loud in different voices? I think a really compelling application, though, is in keeping us connected to our loved ones. So this is nothing to do with disability, but, you know, my mother lives in LA. I live in Boston. If I could text her once in a while and she could hear that text come out in my voice, I can continue to be connected to her where I don't have the time to leave her a voicemail or I don't have the time to, you know, send that message. Or I could do the same thing with my kids who, you know, lately I don't see a whole lot. So could I text them? And it doesn't replace the regular contact, but it augments our connection because voice is a very important way in which we keep our relationships with people that we love.
Hmm. You could also potentially leave a record of your voice behind after you're gone.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's a really important piece. So I think sometimes, a lot of times, Vocal ID lately, you know, we think about it as for the person who is unable to speak. But all of us have a voice. And it is for those who can't speak, but it's also for yourself. You can bank your voice for yourself and for your loved one so that they have that legacy of you.
What about the possibility for traveling and speaking into a device and having sound come out in the language of whoever you're trying to communicate with abroad who does not speak English?
I love it. You have to be on our R&D team. So yeah, there's so many.
I can think of the ideas. I just don't know how to execute them.
Yeah. And I think that there's so many exciting applications. There are about, I think, 500 million devices that use some kind of text-to-speech application today. And there's going to be 20 billion very soon. More and more things are starting to talk. More and more applications, from your apps that can read you out loud your recipes to, you know, finding your best music, the music that you like, and so on and so forth. There are so many things that are going to begin to talk to us. Not just physical things, but applications. And we're not going to be satisfied with having a handful of voices. We're going to want voices with accents. We're going to want voices that are hesitant. We're going to want voices that are convincing. We're going to want voices that are us, that are spunky, that are alive, right? And so this is just the beginning. And I think, like with many technologies, they become invented because there's some need, a huge need, and in this case is the need for someone who has been living with voicelessness, has been given a voice that's just like a generic sounding voice. But that need, if we can then help it penetrate into the rest of the world, it's making accessible what initially was, you know, really for just a small group of people, it makes it mainstream. So I think that's the vision that we have for this, is where can we take this? Because we have to elevate the conversation about voice and what voice means to us and what we want it to mean in our technologies as well that help us communicate.
Adrian wants to know from Twitter how long it takes to complete a full voice set. How many hours? You said it was 3,500 sentences. How many hours is that?
So it takes on average somewhere between 5 to 7 hours to complete the recording set. You don't do it at once. You do it in little 10 to 15 minute sessions. And that's because also you'll have the best quality voice. So talking for an hour, you know, takes a toll on someone's voice. So you want to have it, chop it up into little bits with rests in between. Some younger kids sometimes take a little bit longer because they listen to themselves after every sentence. and that's very endearing. And it's great. We do want you to listen to the samples initially because we want to make sure that the sound recordings are of good quality. And the best markers or the best people to judge that is going to be yourself after you've made a recording. Sometimes once you've gotten used to it or once you've done a few sentences, you don't have to listen to every single sentence, so you can move on much more quickly. We do offer community service hours for those high school students and college students that need that, and we're working on ways in which we can gamify this more. But we are a small startup, and so we're trying to figure out ways in which we can also get people in the community to help us kind of do what we call voice drives. A voice drive is gathering together, you know, 20 to 25 people, and collectively you motivate each other to get through this process.
Hmm. Most surprising challenge, anything that you did not foresee?
The challenge, I think that there's so many challenges. Most surprising challenge. You got me there.
That's okay. We can leave it at that. It sounds like things are going well for you. Rupal Patel.
There's lots of challenges. I think there isn't one that's more surprising than the other.
Rupal Patel is director of the Communication Analysis and Design Laboratory at Northeastern University. You can learn more about her work at her company's website, vocalid.co. Rupal, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thank you, Chris. This was wonderful.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Girabet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And the show's new Twitter is at KERA Think. This is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.